This is the audio version of the core material for the PDH Center live online course on Overview of Electrical Engineering Design for Schools. Your instructor is Tom Mason, PE. Mr. Mason has performed electrical design for about 20 Greenfield schools and about 60 major renovations, including new buildings, air conditioning, retrofit, and computer labs. He is employed as lead electrical engineer for a mid-size, full-service architectural engineering firm. Mr. Mason?
This online course discusses each of the responsibilities of the electrical designer on a new school or school renovation project. Three areas receive special focus: coordination, regulations, and design. Coordination is central because it results in economies for the project and high end user satisfaction. Regulations are addressed because in many ways they provide the basis for a good design, as well as the fact that oversights can impose very expensive delays and possible redesign for the project. Design, of course, is the preparation of construction documents, drawings, and specification. Commissioning and acceptance are given short shrift in this course because they are so often performed by other persons and so often deleted from the project. Optional narrative. In response to users' requests, narrative material is included in this revision of the PDH Online Electrical Engineering for School Design course. Paragraph like this in boxes, and you'll have to trust me, I'm reading from a box, contain references to now obsolete codes, reports of field experience with plans examiners, and contractors and extraneous opinions. Content is not included in the quiz. The quiz at the end is designed to enhance your understanding of the course materials and increase your confidence in applying the principles herein contained. The course is intended for project managers, electrical engineers, engineers and architects who work with electrical engineers, and for contractors. Some students will want to verify every detail. Others may only be interested in a topic is addressed by the designer and wish to gain a little insight into the controlling factors. Both groups' needs should be well met. The greater hazard in school design is entirely missing a requirement, more than in adopting a less accepted interpretation of the code. Design professionals with experience in work on schools will recognize most steps, but may be a little surprised by the constraints that the electrical engineer is working under. Persons new to electrical design may be overwhelmed by the range of responsibilities for the electrical engineer. The result should be that future school design jobs will encounter fewer miscommunications and missteps. At the conclusion of this course, the student will know the source of New York State funding and design guidelines and areas covered, be able to discuss advantages and disadvantages of primary electric service and secondary electric service, be familiar with contents and use of means estimating guide for preliminary construction estimates, know the information required before talking to the electrical utility about service or service upgrade, be familiar with the architect's design basis drawings and how they control the electrical design, understand design responsibilities and ethical implications when using sub-consultants, be able to list National Electric Code requirements for service disconnects and grounding, know the difference in cost and performance of switchboards and panel boards, know the rule of thumb power requirements for air conditioning, electric heat, and pump requirements for HVAC, know the ASME and State of New York electrical requirements for elevator installation, know the special National Electric Code and NFPA requirements for emergency generators, understand the principles of load flow and short circuit analysis and how they affect the choice of electrical protective devices. Now, that is not to say you will be able to perform load flow and short circuit analysis at the end of the course, but you'll understand what's going on when it's needed and have some insights into how to read the results. There is a separate PDH online course on short circuit analysis. Understand and be able to use the lighting power budgets in ASHRAE 90.1 energy code. Understands advanced lighting control strategies for daylight harvesting, motion sensors, and equipment required to implement them. Know the basic design rules for data and telephone cable plant design. Understand basic technologies used for access control, including card readers, door position switches, magnetic locks, and computerized controls. Understand the basic technologies used for perimeter monitoring, including motion detectors, glass break detectors, and closed-circuit television. Understand low-voltage wiring requirements of the National Electric Code as used for school public address clock and bell systems. Be able to confidently fill out the NFPA form to determine the need for lightning protection. And understand the critical requirements of NFPA 72, the fire alarm code. And by the way, there is a separate PDH online course on the fire alarm code. Before we start the design, we must identify the scope of work and the players. For this class, the scope is a generic school containing components in the following sketch. Now, of course, in the audio version, you don't have the sketch, so I will try to relate to you what's going on. This is a generic school because all schools share similar components. When I was preparing this, I was worrying about kitchens because there's a trend these days to eliminate the kitchens and having a warming area instead with a central commissary that prepares all the food for the district and then ships them out in covered containers, and they're just held for the kids to come by and pick up their trays. But actually, the requirements for a kitchen and the requirements for a warming area are very, very similar. There are typically some high power electric loads. There's some concern about fire. There has to be space for people to come through, and very often the health department requires the same washdown in a food warming area as in a food preparation area. Now, this is dependent upon local conditions, but there are a lot of similarities between the two. In our sketch of the generic school, we've got a front office with the principal's office, the attendance office, guidance counselor, the secretaries that make the school work, things like that. We've got a media center, which I continue to call a library. You'll have to forgive me. It is a media center because they've gone to an awful lot of trouble to put central computers in the media center and put DVD services, digital video recorder services. It's a lot more than just a library. It's very common for the main computer room to also be the media center or a corner of the media center. Eating area and kitchen, which is not a surprise. Boilers, air conditioning, and electric service. As designers, these are of critical importance to us. Teachers and students don't think about it much, hopefully never have to think about it at all. In the boiler AC electric room, we have to worry about chillers. We probably have an emergency generator, becoming very, very common. Some states are requiring every school have an emergency generator. Incoming power service, incoming data and telephone service, typically, once again, to the electric room. In a newer design, you might have a communications room. But people aren't aware of the fact that the National Electric Code covers data and telephone and applies many of the same rules to power and data and telephone. Things like the service entrance, grounding at the service entrance, and tying the ground together with the service ground. So it's a convenience to have the telephone service near the electric room, even though the data guys kind of go nuts when they think of 480 volts or 13,200. Delivery and storage, which we're not going to talk about much, except it's a place of high importance if you're talking security. Yes, there's vandalism in schools, and that's what makes the news all the time, but meat disappearing from the locker is probably more of a loss to the school than an occasional computer disappearing from a classroom. And restrooms, and hallways, and classes, and classes, and classes. And a parking lot, because we will talk about exterior lighting a little bit. To one of these optional narratives, the course is on electrical design, in the broadest sense, with a school as the example to see how the tasks fit together. This is not a course in school design. On the other hand, schools have changed considerably even in the last 5 years. Unless you have a student with a lot of activities, you probably don't know about the innovations that are now standard. The sketch we've just discussed is not typical. Schools today are wide, but don't fit well on a single sheet of typewriter paper. States require that almost all classrooms have outside windows, and substantial savings are available if elementary and preschool classrooms have outside doors. Locker-lined halls are universal for all but the smallest students, that is, the elementary kids still hang their coats in the back of the room. The funding agencies will support classrooms, labs, library, gyms, shared eating areas. These will be sized for the student population. It's hard to get money for restrooms, offices, kitchens, teachers' work areas, and boiler rooms. These will be sized to the minimum regulatory requirements, or even a little smaller. Space for data equipment has only recently been recognized as a need and has been lumped into the media to share the library. Depending on the local conditions, all schools now have central air conditioning and an emergency generator. All schools must take delivery of foodstuffs, replacement light bulbs, and lots and lots and lots of toilet paper. The reason I mention the toilet paper is not just to wastewater experience. No, it's a flammable substance. And when you're doing fire alarms, you focus on flammable substance. And toilet paper and paper towels are something you have to worry about. Also, you have to worry about flammable liquids. You certainly don't want the groundskeeping activities to be stored any place that a fire could break out and spread to the rest of the building. Now, the architect will take care of this. This is exactly what he worries about. But there's nothing wrong with somebody looking over his shoulder. If you get a design that has a corner of the boiler room for lawnmower storage, you're not the only one who's going to mention that. The plans examiner will never accept that. And I can't imagine an architect actually presenting something like that. We've got a drawing now of the different players in school design. And this is, let's not call it confusion, this is where the wealth of activities that make up school design come together. In my graphic representation of this, I have the owner at the top because nothing happens without an owner. Off to the side of the owner, I have the funding agencies. In some cases, the funding agencies take an active participation to the extent of hiring the construction manager, and the construction manager reports to the funding agency rather than to the owner. But the funding agencies and the owner are part of every school design. Whether they're a big part or a little part depends in some ways on the details of the project, but they're always there. These people deal with the architect. The architect oversees the project. Now, there's a little bit, let's not say confusion, but maturing viewpoint in this. Many older architects, and I don't mean older by age, I mean people with experience on the way things have been done for years and years, think that the architect does the design of the building. And that's certainly true. I mean, it's a key, critical undertaking. But according to the American Institute of Architects, the architect oversees all of the design efforts and has ultimate responsibility for all the design components. There used to be a complaint all the time about interferences between steel beams and hot water pipes and air conditioning ducts and even an occasional power transformer. And it was always blamed on the designers. Why didn't you coordinate? Well, yes, the designer should coordinate. It's essential they coordinate. But at the end of the day, the architect is responsible for the coordination. Before it's issued, it's his job to check it. Directly impinging upon the architect are responsibilities for the building code. The different requirements for laying out a building, having the walls in the right place, the walls of the right type, and worrying about circulation. I hear that word so often. Architects spend a lot of time being concerned about how people get from here to there. Why does the electrical engineer care? Typically in the fire alarm section, because architects want open access and the fire code wants doors closed so that smoke, toxic fumes, and fire don't spread. Well, how do you combine these two requirements? And it's magnetic door holds. You can have fire doors, but they're normally open, so people can go through, except when the fire alarm trips, the magnet releases, the door closes, and it's a fire barrier. But the building code is the architect's responsibility. Similarly, ADA, Americans with Disability Act, a lot of responsibilities on the architect, some of these things just being defined, pretty clear things about elevators and ramps, but there are other areas. Bathrooms, I think, are pretty well defined. The placement of controls for lighting and telephones come out of ADA, so it does filter down to the electrical as well. The architect is responsible for kitchen selection, usually done through a subconsultant who reports to the architect. Furniture selection, once again, usually subbed out. Structural design is a discipline within the design community, but at the early stages of the project, when you're trying to figure out what building you're going to do and how you're going to fit it to the lot available, the structural design and the architect work very close together, give the results to the other design trades. The electrical engineer works for the architect. No question about it, the immediate client for the electrical engineer is the architect. When the architect is happy, it's a good job. When the architect is not happy, it's not a good job. Now, there are a lot of things to consider along the way, a lot of things that make up the electrical design trade, but making the architect happy is the ultimate measure. Things the electrical engineer must consider are the electric code, the energy code, IESNA, which is the Lighting Society, which has been almost totally supplanted by the energy code. The Lighting Society tells you how much light you have. The energy code tells you how much power you may use. So you try to achieve the Lighting Society, but you're limited by the energy code. And this will show up in the course later, but the energy code has been adopted by all 50 states, and it is law, the watts per square foot that are prescribed. Fire alarm code, which is something very important to us. A QA review, and I put this in here just because it's an essential part of electrical design. The best engineer has oversights, and a separate set of eyes looking at the design before it's released is so valuable. And this is each of the steps of design, the schematic design, the detailed design, the construction documents. Power utility. The electrical engineer is typically the only person who deals with the power utility, certainly the only person who deals back and forth, back and forth. There's a telephone utility, and that may be outside the electrical engineer's purview, but you still got to check with them, make sure that the pipe coming in from the street is coming from where they have a source of data and telephone, and the place where it lands within the building is where the data guys are going to distribute it, or perhaps the electrical engineer is doing the data distribution as well. Cable TV utility. Recently, a number of communities have their cable TV company giving them free fiber optic to connect all the schools in the district. So you wouldn't normally think that cable TV is a big deal, but in some schools, it's the central communication channel for the entire district. And again, get the pipes going to the right place, make sure there's a big enough pipe, make sure there's a spare, because the world is going to change and you want to be able to accommodate it. If there's a data utility, one of the things that's developing is state interactive media centers, where in the state capital or, you know, some podunk farm community that has a good pork barrel relationship, they build this huge structure with lots of videotape players and digital video recorders and all that. And everybody in the state goes down a high-speed data link to it, and instead of watching movies, you watch a data feed from the central instructional media center. So this is something that we have to worry about. Once again, more than anything, just getting the pipe out to the right place, or making sure there's a place for the satellite dish on the roof and a way to penetrate the roof to get down to the media center. Satellite service may be totally independent, but it must be a concern for everyone involved. Detailed data design. We're going to spend a fair amount of time talking about this. We'll talk about EIA, TIA 568 and 569. Fire alarm design, intrusion alarm design, access control design, security CCTV design, instructional delivery design. We touched on that a moment ago. Is it going to be local? Is it going to be central? And for goodness sake, leave provision for future expansion. Telephone design. Is it going to be part of the data system? Is it going to be a totally independent system? Does it have to be running conduits? Are they big conduits? Public address and bells, fire protection, HVAC design, elevator design, roof warranty. And we'll get into each of these as we discuss the course. If the course meets its goals, each of these items will be discussed in some depth. For now, only the names are explained. The center of the universe is, of course, the electrical engineer. We can all stop to laugh. I think the electrical engineer makes a real contribution. When you don't have a good electrical engineer on the project, you have problems. So a good electrical engineer is a member of the team, and let's say an essential contributor. Above him, figuratively, are the architect and owner. The owner is constrained by the amount of money he has available and any restrictions on spending of that money. There can be very, very peculiar restrictions. The architect supplies the innovation at the earliest stages and supervision through the remainder of the project. The architect is limited by the building code and local interpretation of the federal disabilities legislation, ADA. The architect works closely with a kitchen consultant, who usually provides his services and very limited information at no charge in return for a no-bid order on the kitchen equipment. Furniture selection is done the same way, usually with guidance from the owner, who has long-standing relationships with a certain vendor. The structural designer works closely with the architect during the initial layout of the facility, but must be consulted throughout the project to assure that major heavy equipment will be installed properly. Rooftop equipment and piping chases from the rooftop equipment involve structural designer. The electrical engineer works with several well-defined stable regulations. The National Electric Code, the International Energy Conservation Code, the Fire Alarm Code are fairly well understood and enforced by reasonable people. IESNA, the Lighting Society, has very generalized opinion about lighting levels and design. Typically, the project architect has strong opinions. Frequently, the owner has a number of bad experiences he hopes to avoid this time. Coordination and communication are required. Quality assurance review should be a behind-the-curtain activity unknown to the architect, the owner, or other discipline. It works this way on a good job. On a bad job, however, the reviewer has radically different ideas about how the job should be done, and a major brouhaha can result. The electrical engineer must work with the architect to find out from the owner what services are required for the final school. Are they keeping or expanding the existing distant learning via satellite? Who is arranging for the hardware and installation? For power, telephone, cable TV, data, satellite, and other services, questions must be asked and results documented into the construction documents. Typically, the civil and structural disciplines must know what is going on. The list of special systems discussed later may be performed by the electrical engineer or by a subconsultant. Coordination with fire protection, that is sprinklers, HVAC, and elevator are required to meet life safety requirements. Roof warranty appears out of place, but this can be a very expensive item. If the electrician running power to the rooftop HVAC equipment and the technicians hooking up the satellite dishes, district radio, and lightning rods make mistakes, the leaks can be expensive and may not show up for several years. There are 7 distinct sections of this course, corresponding to fairly distinct electrical design responsibilities. They are as follows: pre-design, power, lighting, telephone and data, security, special systems, and workmanship. Pre-design refers to the scope of the project and the plan of who will perform each task required. Power refers to the copper wires and power boxes between the utility pole and the base receptacle. Lighting includes power boxes, wires, and fixtures, but more and more dimming, daylight harvesting, and architectural accents. Telephone and data have become key services to enable school functions. Principles of design and design presentation will be reviewed here, but actual design is often required to be performed by a specially licensed subconsultant. A first-class electronic classroom is indistinguishable from a first-class business conference room. In early days, schools were left unlocked. Today, magnetic locks make it impossible to enter through the doors which have not been intentionally unlocked. Detection of intrusion is associated with $100,000 and more in personal computers and laptop computers in the typical school. Surveillance is required to protect students and staff and to ultimately lock up any perpetrators. Special systems are very, very important. They include lightning protection, fire alarms, clock and bell system, theatrical lighting, television production, satellite television acquisition. We excluded commissioning and acceptance from the course earlier, but some checklists to evaluate the quality of workmanship will be included. They are key concepts with prominence in the specification, drawing notes, and any walkthroughs on site meetings. Following this introduction, we have a section on pre-design, which runs about 30 minutes. There's a section on power that runs about 35 minutes. Lighting takes about 26 minutes. Telephone and data take 15 minutes. Security, 13 minutes. Special systems get 12 minutes. And there's a conclusion of about 3 minutes. I hope you enjoy the course, and I hope it provides value. Please make sure that you include a comment at the end of your quiz form. Help us improve the course. Anything that was missing that you would have found valuable, anything that you think was in error, anything that you think got way too much attention for the way you'll be using the course. Hope you enjoy the course, and I hope the content helps you do your job better and live your life better.